nobody wrote a love song about for arranged couples. My parents and your parents been a-talking. I see them in the village, and I walk in, heard part of what they said. They're working on an exchange. And I know you and I have never dated, and even though we kind of are related, it seems my father sold me to you for some goats. So I can't hesitate no more, no more. It's been arranged. I'm yours. Guess that you could say that, girl, we're friends with socioeconomic benefits. Try to get to know you, have a chat. What's your favorite book? Do you like cats? Try to figure out the things we have in common. Ooh. Oh, that's right, our grandparents.
Hey there. I'm your host, Paul. A few points of context ahead of today's show. First, thank you for listening. I realize there's a lot of material out there, and I'm grateful that you'd spend your time with us. Second, if you want to get a sense of my background and the team that makes this happen, go to paulpodolsky.com. And lastly, if you like the material, please submit a review on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews are the currency of the modern creator economy. The show's been downloaded tens of thousands of times, yet less than 1% of listeners leave a review. And the same, by the way, goes for the essays about politics and money on Substack, and also the books Master Minion and Raising a Thief, and the book that's going to be out next year, Uncomfortable Truths About Money. And with that, let's jump in. My guest today is Remy Mounassefi, who is a comedian, but really much more than that. So welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
It's a pleasure to be here. I listen and consume a lot of the Steel Press stuff, so this is actually a treat for me.
Oh, it's great. So for people who don't know you, and I realize that tens of millions of people have listened to you, your various videos, but that still leaves a couple of billion out. Why don't you just describe just who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So my name is Remy. I make YouTube videos. I've been doing that since 2006 on YouTube, and that's been my job since 2007. I always enjoyed musical comedy growing up, comedy in general, and was very fortunate to have discovered YouTube when it started.
Right. And so there's so many different angles here that are interesting to this, because obviously a lot of people dream now about participating in this new quote unquote creator economy, but many people get their teeth kicked in doing it. It's a little bit by trading, but you figured it out from a lot of different angles. So first of all, describe for a little bit, if you would, why comedy is so important. And then also, if you would, talk about why it changes when you deliver it in a different medium, because comedy to me, the one thing, it's like people kick back and listen to a Netflix special or go to a comedy store or something like that in some parts of the world. And in other parts of the world, you joke and you literally get killed or locked up. So it's kind of a very not serious thing and a kind of really serious thing at the same time.
Yeah. So the first part of your question, why comedy is important, I think about, there's an old country song that starts with the words, life's tough and then you die. And that's what I always kind of, the first thought I have is that, you know, like life is very difficult. Everybody's got their own set of challenges. Even if you're in a place like the United States where you're doing just right off the bat much better than a lot of other parts of the world, life is difficult and it presents yeah. all sorts of challenges. And people are looking for an escape. That's what drew, what I love about comedy is that laughter is, there's nothing like it. And
it literally is good for your health to laugh.
Yes. Well documented. And yes.
When I was preparing for this, I went on an absolute fire hose of all your videos. And normally I'm sitting up here looking at serious stuff and charts. And I was just laughing out loud. And it improved my mood.
That's good. I just had to be funnier than a 10K, you know, like. So that's one of the things that I loved about it. And I think everybody can relate to that. You know, if you've ever told a joke to people and people got a kick out of it and laughed, it's a nice feeling for you telling the joke as well. And so that's what drew me to comedy. That's why I think it's super important and just a great thing.
And there's like a really powerful, like, social commentary part of it, because it seems like a lot of successful comedians, let's say you included, they're trying to touch the nerve. In other words, comedy isn't really funny about stuff that's not somewhat edgy. It's really any type of thing hitting on there and kind of being on the edge, and you're not quite sure if they're going to tip over it. It pulls the audience in a little bit.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of absurdities that present themselves in the world out there. And I think that's some of the best comedy, is when somebody sort of discovers and points out an absurdity that's hiding in plain sight that we might not have been able to put a finger on. Also, I think maybe more so these days, comedians are more willing to, you know, quote unquote, go there or touch that third rail in ways that maybe a lot of other people aren't. So I always appreciate that.
Now, how does it, I mean, the traditional path for a comedian, I grew up in D.C., near where you live now, and I remember there were these comedy clubs you go to, and you would sometimes see famous people there, but it is tough, man. It is a tough forum. There was hecklers there, and you would see really great comedians have to deal with that. It was, I mean, if you got to the level, I remember I saw, you know, when he got bigger, Eddie Murphy, that was a different thing. The audience there sort of laps it up. But at that in-between stage, it's like trial by fire. So did you go through that, or did you go right to YouTube? And how do you compare and contrast those two different forms? How does that change what comedy is?
Well, so my backstory in comedy is I always loved it, and it was always something I wanted to try to do, but I could never get the courage to do it. And in college, we had an annual talent show, and I always thought, and in high school too, but I never did it in high school for the same reasons. But finally, my senior year came up, and I was like, you know what? If I don't try comedy at this thing, I'm probably never going to try it. So let me sign up for it. I loved it. And after that talent show, I went and did open mics at the comedy clubs. I went to school in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I would drive to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and do the open mics at the clubs there. And I was never the best comedian there. It is brutal. So it never really seemed like a viable career option to me. I'd never been in a room where I was like, well, I'm the funniest person in here. It's like, and these are open mic. These are guys who are amateurs, and they're hilarious. There's so many funny people. It never seemed viable. It wasn't until I saw YouTube and I saw these channels that weren't, that they had massive followings and they weren't very good. And I just like a light bulb popped up in my mind. I was like, I'm not good too. You know, I'm just as not good as that guy. And then it seemed like, oh, this could be this. I could do something with this. But you're 100% right. It is tough.
So it's interesting. You knew you had this talent, but then you tried to pick a game where you could win, which is, it's important in investing and in all sorts of things. It's like structure the game so you're structurally advantaged to win.
Yeah, I wanted at least to have some odds. You know, I think that's part of it. It's just having Arab parents who, you know, I was just not looking forward to that conversation. It's like, Mom, Dad, I'm not going to go to law school. I'm going to make jokes on the internet. Yeah. You know, at least have some odds. You know, that don't have to be in your favor, but something.
I want to get to that because that's a whole interesting thread as well. So, what was your first video that really hit? And how long was that before you first started putting up videos? Was it very incremental, or did you have something that just went nuts?
It was definitely incremental. Everything that I had posted seemed to sort of snowball and push the snowball a little bit further. The first video I ever uploaded was about a Senate race that we had here in Virginia at the time in 2006. And it got linked to in the National Journal's online their website. That's what they're called, websites, yes.
Well, I'm from Virginia. This place is my hometown. But by now you probably noticed my face is kind of brown. There's an election coming up. There are signs in all the places. Only problem is the guy that's running kinda is a racist. I normally vote Republican. I'm not sure what to do. I guess I got me a big old case of the Macaca blues. I want to vote conservative, I've done so all along, but do I really want a senator who'll have me mow his lawn? It's a really tough decision, I just don't know what to do. I guess I got me a big old case of the macaca blues. Of the macaca blues. Of the macaca blues.
And that was like, oh wow, just like it's never going to get better than this. And then the second video I did, I made a rap video, and I thought, well, that'd be fun. I'll make a rap video.
Which one was that?
That was called it was called 2% Milk, and I always thought it would be fun to do like a rap imagery is typically very tough.
Yes.
And I thought like, oh, let me contrast this with like how much I like 2% Milk.
Wake up in the morning and my stomach is bare. I get up out of bed and I head downstairs. Grab a spoon and a bowl and some cereal to fill it.
Yo, Rems, we out of milk.
What? I drop bombs in the car, gotta get to the store, cause we all about a milk, we gotta get some more. I'm addicted to the liquid, man, it's like a pill. I got an utter loving craving for some 2% milk.
I thought I would make a rap video and that would be it, but people really seemed to like it, and they were like, when's the next rap video? And I was like, I thought that was gonna be it, but you know, here we are like 15 years later, I'm still making rap videos. But I wouldn't have guessed that, but that just
I saw the 50 Cent one today, whatever your version of the
ARAB. Yes, that was the next one,
and I loved that.
I don't know what you heard about me, but my wife walks 10 feet behind me. I drive a Benz, yeah, I drive Mercedes, cause I'm a Middle Eastern ARAB. I don't know what you heard about me, but I got 2 sandals on my feet. I drive a Beamer or Mercedes, cause I'm a Middle Eastern ARAB. In Hollywood they say there's no business like show business, but in Baghdad we say there's no business like goat business. It makes no sense, but we say it.
Yeah, a lot of the Arab stuff. That was probably going to be one of the few Arab themed videos that I was going to do if they didn't really end up having a following. But that ended up being the most popular thing that I have probably done to date. Is just the Arab themed content for a lot of Arab kids in America that had a similar upbringing as I did.
Which goes to, do you have any idea who your audience is? When it gets this big, do you have any idea if there's a center point? Do you get any data, or do you just sort of sense it?
Well, if I had any brain cells functioning at the time I started the channel, I would have probably narrowed down the focus, because I have a lot of Arab themed things, and I had really hyper niche things. Like I did a rap about Arlington, Virginia. And I mean, if I meet somebody who liked that video, they're like, are you ever going to make a second video? Whereas the people who watch the Arab videos or have never seen that video. So I probably would have been done better to focus on one and try to get a more defined audience in that sense. But I normally just whatever I'm inspired to make any particular day, I just kind of go in that direction.
There's a lot of, and I guess where we cross paths, there's a lot of your, not, I don't know a lot, but there's certainly a chunk of your videos that have an explicitly financial theme to them, about homes, about Bitcoin, about Dogecoin, which I'm really intrigued at, because I think that everybody worries about money, but the minute you begin talking about it, most people just fall asleep instantly. Like the if you just want to kill a conversation, say the words central bank, and everybody's like... okay, I need a cup of coffee for this or whatever, Diet Coke or something like that. Yet you take on this theme and it seems to resonate with people. So how do you step into that? And is that something that you're conscious of, that people worry about money, but that it's deadly boring?
Part of that challenge is what is kind of draws me to it. I always love contrasts and trying to take something that's maybe wonky and nerdy and sort of would make your mind gloss over, to try to communicate it in a way that's more consumable. That's one of the things I actually like. You know, every now and then I go back on some YouTube rabbit hole watching Warren Buffett Berkshire meeting videos, because he's such a great communicator. I always appreciated that. But I always thought that would be, there's a lot of humor in that contrast. So I'm always interested in trying to pick a topic that's kind of like that. But I do have interest in that field sort of, and those types of topics as well.
Describe your process a little bit. Like, do you have a, you know, what's the life of a YouTube creator like? Are you just sort of going for, what's your standard day like? Do you think, when do these things come to you? Do you have a production schedule you stick to, or is it more intuitive?
I used to be more structured. I used to try to sit down and, I'm going to be writing from this hour to this hour. And I would put myself in front of my laptop or my notebook and I'd try to do jokes. And I did that for a very long time. And a lot of times I would just go to a public library. We have a few around here.
Yeah, great places. They're like sacred institutions.
Exactly. And when COVID happened, they closed all the libraries. And I was like, I don't even know what to do. I don't even really have a desk. So I wasn't doing anything. I would just go on a walk. I was walking more because everything was closed. But somehow, not only did the videos got written, I was actually somehow more productive. So since about 2020, I decided to just like keep as little of a schedule as possible and just kind of trust that something will occur to me.
Uh-huh.
And then when it does, it'll come out effortlessly. For the last few years, that has been the case. I don't know if that will continue. Certainly sometimes I'll have like a draft of something and it'll just be bad. And I have to sit down and be like, okay, let me work this out because this is not working. And then that'll require more of the former focus. But nowadays, it's just trying to keep as open a schedule as possible and just allowing for kind of inspiration to strike. And if that happens to be the case, just kind of go down that rabbit hole.
So effectively, in a way, you're sort of, who owns YouTube? Google owns YouTube, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically like a little tiny nodule in Google in a way, because you're totally dependent on that forum. So a couple of questions. First of all, how does the compensation literally work? So if an ad, when I clicked on your videos, there's always an ad there. Do you get a chunk of that? Literally the mechanics of how do you make a living on this?
Yeah. So you get a chunk of the ad revenue. A lot of channels will also do merchandising type things where they'll do, have a website. I started a channel more recently than my first channel just a few years ago, where most of the revenue comes from the website, where there's merchandise for sale. And you can also do a lot of channels do product placement, or they'll do ad reads in the middle of the video, not dissimilar to the podcast space. And so normally most of the people that I know that do YouTube have like a few streams. And especially for the smaller channels, I think that's just a necessity.
So it's your website, just a random YouTube search, then specific channels on YouTube that you run.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yes. So the website being just a store, just like a Shopify store. And so you can promote the store on your channel, which is what a lot of the most of the channels on YouTube have some sort of merchandise or some sort of, I know a lot do like services like classes, if they're an educational sort of thing, you know, this is my free content, but I have like a class behind some sort of paywall.
But you don't, you just do, your thing is ad revenue and then whatever. What are you selling for merchandise?
We do apparel. We just started doing apparel, have game accessories. The new channel is devoted to its comedy videos that are about Magic the Gathering trading card game. And so we have card accessories and things like that. That channel has a very defined audience. It's of fellow nerds.
Let's go to the air background. So your father is from Iraq originally, right?
Correct, yes.
Your mother is from Lebanon, is that right?
Yeah.
Where were you born? Were you born here or there?
I was born in Washington, D.C. a number of years after my dad escaped Iraq after the Ba'ath Party took over and made his way to Lebanon and then ultimately here. That was his intent. And my parents got married here. Then I was born shortly thereafter.
And did you grow up speaking Arabic at home?
So my parents spoke Arabic to each other. They were worried that they definitely wanted us to be American. So they did not have us speak it. Yeah. And it was only till very recently, I wish, because to this day, I speak Arabic very poorly. I can understand Lebanese people, and there, that has its own little frustration when it comes to speaking, struggle to come up with the words. But that's a bucket list item. I think I would like to get better at speaking it.
And then you've picked on that as a theme somewhat, or you've used that material in some of your videos, which is it's interesting, it's unique. I don't know if other people, I mean, there's what I saw about the Arab dating sites, and you're making fun of the religious restrictions in Saudi Arabia, etc. Like, what has been the reaction of that stuff? Like if I put on the list of places where you could get into some trouble being a comedian, some of those countries are among them. So how has the diaspora or even people in those countries responded to it? Because it's a global medium.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I probably wouldn't have kept making the content if it wasn't so popular over there. So it's one of the things that was really surprising is obviously a lot of the people who grew up here and had similar upbringings made a connection with the content. But a lot of the views came from overseas, especially on those videos. I mean, I think I had like this is broad. I'm painting it with a broad brush, but I think it was about 60%. North America and 40% overseas audience watching that stuff. So I haven't performed much in the Middle East, but we did perform in Dubai. I have a song called Saudis and Audis, and it's just...
Yeah, I saw that.
Hey there, hottie, hey there, cutie, want a ride in my Audi? I drive fast in high-speed moody, passing like I am Doug Flutie. It has everything you need, imitation leather seat, heater so it don't get colder, even has a mustache holder, headlights so I see at night, cup holder for my surprise. It has flex fuel, don't you know? Runs on gas and on cologne. You think that my judgment's cloudy. You say that it's pronounced Audi. Hit mute button, quit your fussing. It's car, it's not belly button.
I stretch one joke into 3 minutes somehow, but afterwards, some guys from Saudi Arabia had driven to Dubai. I don't know geography well. I didn't even know that was possible, but they had brought their Audi.
Yeah, that's across the desert. Yeah.
Yeah. And they loved the music, and they had made this long trek to come to the show. And I was like, wow, like just to see it in person, like the, you know, you see like numbers on a screen, like, oh, 40% came from these countries.
Yeah.
But to see it in practice, it was really cool.
That's awesome. So they took this thing all as good natured sort of ribbing, mm-hmm. as opposed to like a mockery of anything, because it's, I mean, it is a little bit mocking, but it's also very, very playful and lighthearted at the same time. So I didn't know whether, you know, people would take offense at that.
Yeah, certainly. And certainly living here, you know, now I remember just not even thinking much about jokes growing up, you know, it's like, yeah. Oh, but that's a joke. Yeah. You know, now I think more people are willing to try to dissect someone's intent or if there's a deeper this or that, but that was great. It was great to see.
It's also such a banal thing, but I've seen this, which is, hey, you know, on the dog, you know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Like the whatever that, what was it? Was that comedian who's the Far Side guy, Gary Larson. But just the reach of it is unbelievable. I look at this podcast too, and people listen to it all over the friggin' world. It's nowhere nearly as popular as your stuff. Maybe it'll get there. But people listen to it all over the world. And I love that. Like, you know, the people are downloading these conversations in Nigeria and in Vietnam and in China and in Russia and in Ukraine. And I'm like, that is amazing. But I never get to meet the people that much who are listening to it on the other end. But somewhere out there on a car, somebody in awful traffic is going to be listening to this conversation and whiling away the traffic and hopefully laughing.
So, I mean, that is really cool, especially for content that's so long form. You don't accidentally listen to an episode of this show. You know, it's they're long. You know, maybe on YouTube something's auto playing and like, oh yeah, that Saudi and Audi video came on and I just let it go. I was, you know, microwaving something. even to this day, this many years after the advent of the internet, it still does blow my mind how many barriers have been removed in helping just broadcast. You know, this would
living testimony to that. I mean, literally, your job could not have existed, you know, whatever, 30 years ago. How do your parents make sense of this thing now? Were they initially like, oh, my son's gone off the deep end? And now they're like, holy mackerel, this thing actually works.
Yeah, well, it's easier now, you know, but certainly at the time. And I don't know that I blame them, honestly, having kids now.
Totally.
Yeah, I really get it.
My kids tell me harebrained stuff, and I'm like, that is not a sound idea.
Exactly, exactly.
Like the people who in your videos.
I think that's totally fair. I think I would have the same reaction as my parents did. But the tougher thing at the time was like having to, the internet is, I mean, this is 2006. Certainly YouTube was not like a household name, but just in the functionings of the internet too, my parents was not plainly clear how all of this would work. So it must have sounded like an especially terrible idea to them. But thankfully, you know, when I say it now, like, oh, I started in 2006 and it became my job in 2007, it sounds like it wasn't very long, but that was a very long year.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. Now, your production is super lead. Like, when I watch your videos, you're playing basically, it looks like your chauffeur might be a buddy or something like that. But most of the roles, it's you doing everything.
Yeah.
What's that like?
That's a personal choice, especially now. A lot of YouTube channels you watch, they look a lot like television. One of the things that I loved about YouTube was it's got that authentic feel, that sort of raw, homemade quality to it that sort of separates it. And that's what I like about podcasts too. Like, podcasts have like a feel of their own. So I like staying true to that when possible. I mean, sometimes if I have like a music video and I want to be like flying on an eagle, you know, okay, then we got to do some like graphic work. But this channel that I referred to earlier, that I started a few years ago, that's just gaming. If I can make a video on that channel using nothing but an iPhone, I would gladly do it. Most of the videos on the channel are just done like that because I love that stuff.
You know, the podcast is called Things I Didn't Learn in School. You've been at this a while. A lot of people really do aspire to somehow figure out this thing. You know, what are the biggest things you've learned in this process that you'd make other people aware of? Because it's definitely they're not teaching courses on it.
This one sounds cliche, but I'll follow up. Be yourself. Some of the biggest mistakes I've made is when I'm trying to make content like somebody else. And that's so easy. I grew up getting the Weird Al albums and the Adam Sandler albums. And I obviously didn't invent musical comedy, so there's going to be some inspiration coming from somewhere. But the ideas that I've had that I'm almost not even made because they were too silly, or I was like, oh, I'm the only person that's going to think this is funny. Those have ended up being some of the most successful videos that I've made. It's easy to talk yourself out of doing something like, oh, Saudis
what's
and Audis.
What's an example of that?
Saudis and Audis is a great example where it's just it's ridiculous. I mean, it's ridiculous on the top line. It's called Saudis and Audis. It's just going to be about Saudis driving Audis. It's ridiculous when you watch it, but it ended up being probably, I think, maybe like the second biggest video I ever made. And I almost didn't post it. But sort of leaning into that you'll find your voice, especially now. Who knows what the future is going to be like? Who knows if all content is going to start to sound similar? If it's AI generated or aided, just having a voice that's uniquely yours, I think, is going to be paramount.
I think that is a great lesson, and it's a strange thing. You know, you'd think that the cacophony on the internet would sort of just obliterate all that sensitivity, but I actually find the exact opposite, which is that for some reason through all of this, and I think it's actually one of the real limitations of AI, it seems to be that the audience can really, really sense authenticity and curiosity super fast. That's it's a powerful thing. And just sort of following that, I mean, again, I'm not writing humor, but I just try to say, like, just write one sentence that's true, okay? Now just write another one. That's all it is. And then when you run out of sentences to write, stop. And then move on to something else. That's it. And that kind of settles a lot of stuff. And I think that trying to sound like somebody else, it is tricky because I certainly, my stuff, you know, both the book writing and the other stuff, I consume an enormous amount of material. So there is some influence, but you really got to stick with your own thing. And if you think about at least like the writers, et cetera, who I'm really taken with, they have a very distinct voice. And I guess in comedy, it's the same thing. You know, George Carlin sounds completely different
than Bill Burr.
Yeah.
And it's because they've gone through the hell of sort of refining what the, not the hell, or at least the process of refining what that voice is.
Yeah. And to your point about refining, it's one of the great things about YouTube. You can go look up old clips and you can see early George Carlin. And then really when he found his voice and kind of leaned into it, you know, because I could totally understand why somebody wouldn't be as confident to sort of put themselves out there like he ultimately did. And even Bill Burr is a great example of that. You know, he's really refined his act and voice and just legendary at this point.
I think people probably have been telling jokes for thousands of years because it's just necessary. It's part of the human condition. But I think that stories are a necessary part of the human condition. Like comedy, it seems to me, it's just a different form of storytelling. It can be absurd, but it's storytelling. Mm-hmm. And like your thing about Bitcoin was like you could write 5 essays about why Bitcoin and what money is. And I wrote some of those essays too. But I think that your thing is just a different way of accessing the same thing and in some ways much, much better. And so I think we need stories. It's just a question of how you get them.
Yeah, I think to your point, the more the better, you know, just everybody kind of using their own voice to communicate how they see things. And I think the world's just better in general.
How should people keep up with your work? What's the easiest way? You have a mailing list that you send out? Or
I should yeah. This many years in, but I don't. I post the video links on Twitter at GoRemy.
Great. Well, I know we got a bunch of, well, we got listeners all over, but we do have some listeners in the Middle East, so they should be particularly tuned in. All right, Remy, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
An honor, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.